From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. What dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil? It's a line from Shakespeare that refers to the troubles we humans have on the day-to-day and to our physical state. The rules in day-to-day healthcare are not poetic, though. You can have insurance and end up waiting 6 hours in an emergency room for basic care. And while healthcare consumers might have a, well, bone to pick with the system, so do doctors. We're going to look at how healthcare providers are making do with Dr. Thomas Lee. He's a primary care physician in Boston and an associate editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And Dr. Tanish Walford, a primary care physician. She just sold her Beverly Hills private practice. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks very much.
So, Dr. Walford, let me start with you. You had a private practice in Beverly Hills, California until recently, and you sold to another doctor. So why'd you do that? What happened?
It's been a complicated year. Earlier on in the year, with the high gas prices and the shift in the economy, a lot of my patients were being downsized from their jobs. And, you know, when you go from full-time to part-time, you lose your insurance benefits. And, you know, things at home are getting tighter. So they would dance around whether or not they needed to keep their appointment. But initially, they would still try to get their prescriptions filled. And so at least all of their prescriptions, and pretty soon they would miss appointments and not refill prescriptions and make individual decisions not to come into the office. In addition, that if the ones that did come in started to not pay their outstanding balances or pay them with checks with insufficient funds and just asked for a lot of favors. And initially I gave in, but when the numbers started to increase, it started to put my accounts in the red. And that and a lot of other circumstances, you know, just led me to throw in the towel, so to speak, in primary care and in private practice anyway, solo practice.
So when people go in for health care, some people go in and they just need regular care, but they go to an emergency room because they don't have insurance. Some people have, you know, a private doctor with a private practice like you had. Some people go into, you know, HMOs. Do you think it's harder for people in private practice like the one that you had in this environment?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because the problem lies in the solo or the small practice in that our books, they need to, you need to get paid in a short interim. You need to get paid in 1 to 3 months in order to keep up with the overhead costs, your receptionist, your nurse, the charge, your leasing charges, all your supplies, not to mention vaccines and all these really, really high cost items. And what starts to happen is that, you know, people start not paying their bills or letting their bills go delayed 3 to 6 months even. And then you can't pay your bills because that money needs to come in, your accounts receivable needs to get received. Mm-hmm. And for the smaller practitioner, there isn't a lot of, there's no buffer, right. You know, whereas a larger group could probably absorb a lot of that. You know, they could probably not be paid for up to a year and still absorb a lot of that. In the smaller mid-level practitioner, that's not an option.
Well, Dr. Walford, I want to ask in a second kind of what you see in the future, but I want to go to Dr. Lee. Now, Dr. Lee, in November, you wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about the importance of primary care physicians in the healthcare system. So given what we've been talking about, what kind of strains do you see?
Well, I think we're going through a really messy transition right now where the healthcare system has been paying people like Dr. Walford and people like me for doing transactions, for doing visits, for doing tests, and for doing procedures. And that system isn't working so great. Its costs are going up wildly. And so the payment systems responded just by decreasing the amount they paid and taking their time and paying it. The transition that's underway, though, is to something new that's not yet formed, but we'll be getting paid in the future for something else, for like taking care of people, for producing outcomes. But the payment system isn't there yet, and our office practices aren't there yet. And I think it is very hard for the small independent practice like Dr. Walford's former practice was to handle things during this transition.
What do you see ahead, Dr. Lee? I mean, do you see for example, politics affecting healthcare. There's a lot of talk about whether or not a new presidential administration is going to really change the game. Do you see the tremendous economic changes creating a system where it's very difficult for anyone but people who provide very specialized services to survive as sole practitioners? What do you see ahead?
Well, I'm an optimistic guy, and I think that the combination of politics and the economy are going to lead to big change, which will ultimately make healthcare much better and financially sustainable. But the realistic side is that the transition that's upon us is going to be brutal, and it's going to be very hard on everyone. But the two big forces politically and economically are we got to cover people. We have to find a way of getting health care insurance for everyone. It's just not sustainable when 47 million people don't have insurance, and it's going to become 50 million with the economic downturn. And then the economic downturn also affects companies, taxpayers, by really making it imperative that we move to some different way of paying people than diminishing fees for every visit, so that doctors like Dr. Wolfer just are working harder and harder and falling farther and farther behind.
Dr. Wolfer, before I ask you what lies ahead for you, just give me an example of what you think this is doing to patients. Give me an example of course, you don't have to use a name, but someone who had been a patient of yours who, and what's going to happen to that person now that you're leaving private practice?
I've actually had some significant feedback from some of my patients through the physician that purchased my practice. And the biggest concern that I have is for some of the patients that had developed a significant trust relationship with me and had really committed with me to improve their health. And in really drastic ways, like smoking cessation, complete dietary changes after heart attacks and cholesterol lowering and massive weight loss with type 2 diabetes. And those people I would see on a regular basis, even accepting the smaller reimbursement from the insurance company, because they needed more emotional support to actually accomplish the goals that we had set together. And my biggest concern right now is that it took them years to develop that rapport with me, and I would hate for them to slip through the cracks and for them to not achieve their goals or not even be able to continue in that same venue without the support.
And what's ahead for you?
For myself?
Mm-hmm.
For myself, I'm heading towards a large group practice that can absorb all of these extra costs, and they can have the staffing that can support all the needs that primary care patients require.
Dr. Lee, when you think about what options people will have, do you see a lot of what are, what might have been called family doctors just throwing in the towel and either joining large practices, HMOs, leaving the profession? I mean, what's going to happen to people who have been caregivers who really know the name of all of their patients and have a long relationship with them?
Well, I think that the standalone solo physician practice, it is going to be very tough for it to survive. And I actually don't think it's worth spending too much time mourning it, because it's inevitable. In this day and age, you don't take care of sick patients by yourself. There's just too much to know, too much to do. No one can know everything, and you have to work with groups, and you have to have electronic medical records so that the other people know what you've done. And it's very tough for solo docs to do this. Now, what I do think is imperative is that big organized groups in medicine have to adopt systems and approaches where they give warm, personalized care to people. I don't think you should have to choose between friendly, personalized care and getting it from a well-coordinated, financially viable group. But, you know, there is a challenge there.
Dr. Walford,
yes.
If you had one piece of advice for a patient, you know, what would it be in terms of advocating for themselves in the healthcare system, finding a doctor?
That's a difficult question. But I guess they need to find a practitioner, a physician that will be honest with them, even when it really hurts. They need to find someone that they trust enough that when they hear honesty, they can respond appropriately to it.
So you mean when you have a diagnosis that's negative, or you just tell them, you know, lose weight or die, or stop smoking or die, that they listen to you?
Yeah, but it doesn't have to come across like, you know, like a billboard ad, you know, driving in and then you drive past and it's gone. But someone that will give you that information but also guide you to achieve results.
Well,
so that would be the best situation.
Well, Dr. Walford, Dr. Lee, appreciate talking to you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you.
We were speaking with Dr. Tanish Walford, a primary care physician who just sold her Beverly Hills private practice, and she joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. We also spoke with Dr. Thomas Lee, a primary care physician in Boston and associate editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. How black are you in the office? What I mean is, when you go to work, do you change how you talk to people and present yourself? Even if you do you think it really makes a difference? Take the issue of identity, then make that fractal. An Asian American man might face one set of assumptions when he walks in the door at his job. A straight white man and a gay white man might face different assumptions depending on where they work. When we go to work or school, we leave a little bit of ourselves at the door. What are the best ways to navigate your identities in the workplace? Well, in a moment, we'll get a personal story from Clovey Jean Good. She's a member of Southern California's Local 94 in the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. But first, we'll talk to R. LaRue Lewis. He's an assistant professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So we've all heard, some of us have had to live with, the stereotypes of, say, the angry black woman or the geeky, desexualized Asian man. Seen and unseen identities can impact perceptions in the workplace every day. So how do our identities, whether it's, you know, how we look, how we talk, all that, impact how we work?
Well, I think the first thing is to acknowledge that identity is multifaceted. We all have race identity, class identity, gender identities, and sexual orientations. And while we may have a core belief about who we are that doesn't change, the way we present ourselves does. When we walk into a workplace, what are the things we say? How do we speak? Even what do we eat? Those type of things are what's important about the presentation of identity. Some of the work that I've done with a colleague, Dr. Kanika Bell at Clark Atlanta, has said that the social context and the situation of encounter matter most for your presentation. So when you walk into a work setting as an African-American male, are you more conscious of the way you dress and the way that you speak? Even though at the core I am who I am, in order to be successful at jobs, we often have to change behaviors and practices to get along.
I'll give you a personal example. You know, I'm sitting here right now wearing an outfit I got in South Africa, and I'm on radio, so you wouldn't know that unless I mentioned it. When I worked in broadcast television for ABC News, I had a very limited wardrobe choice. That was just what everybody wore, kind of like the power suit. And so when you have someone who, you know, you can be the same person and dress differently, but are you really perceived differently even if you change some of the outside signifiers?
I think you definitely are. Every workplace has a culture of its own, and wearing a dashiki in to work on radio is different than wearing mud cloth in on a corporate environment. People will read you as different. People will read you as nonconformist, and nonconformity in the workplace can be read as a negative characteristic. While it may not relate to your work productivity, people will perceive you as different and think that you're not trying to be a team player, which is really the key when we're talking about advancement and the ways in which things like race and gender identity mix with the work world.
Give me an example of how people can deal, whether it's from your perspective as a worker or from your perspective as a manager with some of the assumptions that come up in the workplace and if there's tensions around them, whether it's tensions around gender, tensions around race, tensions around sexual orientation. If you're in a situation where you can see people are kind of going off the rails and doing things that are destructive or mean-spirited, how can you kind of get in the middle of it or intervene or ask for help?
Well, I'll come at it from the worker's perspective because that's the experience that I have the most with. First, recognize the stakes. If there's already a conflict brewing, where are you in the ladder, in the hierarchy? Are you able to suggest, you know what, maybe we should calm this conversation down and go into a different place? Or will your entering into the conversation or making a comment really threaten your likelihood of survival at the place? Second, I would say you need to find allies. Find other people at your job who may not have traditional identities that match with the work environment. If you're the first woman, look for other folks who may be the first openly gay person who are on the job. So finding ways in which they negotiate those situations. Third, be very alert but not preemptive. Recognize being the first or the only person on a work environment may mean that you have issues around your identity, but that doesn't mean every time your identity is brought up that it's an issue or a cause for concern. And lastly, you have to be open to extending conversations, recognizing that people will come to you as someone who may look different or seem different and want to talk with you, but also you have to suggest to extend this to an institutional conversation. How can the work environment be shifted? How could we even bring in consultants to make sure that everyone's identities and everyone's backgrounds are equally valued in creating a collaborative work environment?
Well, Professor Lewis, when you think about solutions, you've mentioned some very good ones for individuals, but what about the whole idea of diversity training? It's something that some people go to a company and they're kind of compelled to go through some kind of training. Other people, it'll never come up. But what do you think of the whole idea of what diversity training is and whether or not it's effective?
Well, I think diversity training in its original context out of this multiculturalism movement in which everyone comes in and explores their differences and agrees to be happy to be different doesn't actually help us move that far along in the workplace. Instead, I like the models of people like Carmen Van Krokov with New Demographic or Rayshawn Ray with Engaged Diversity, where people start with discussing who they are and how those identities matter for privilege and power. If we're talking about differences at work, we have to really recognize that some people have more of an ability to be who they are openly and other people have less. And how can we reshape the conversation not to just concentrate on difference, but differences in power, privilege, and the potential to create a collaborative space?
How would you rate your own experience? Meaning, you're a professor, and academia can be very politicized, but it's also a place where, you know, these discussions are not considered totally out of the blue. How would you rate the kind of conversations that go on in the context in which you operate?
I think for many people it'd be hard to believe that academia struggles with the same issues. It's a workplace environment. Just because people may be professionals doesn't mean that they're necessarily used to dealing with these issues. So one of the first things I have to recognize as a young African-American male is that I'm often elected to be a role model or serve on committees of diversity requirements. What is important for me is to make sure to hold back and not jump at every opportunity that's provided, because in spaces that have historically not included people who are African American, institution can be very excited to have you present and wants you to do work. But those additional burdens of work can also prohibit me from doing my primary job of researching and educating students.
So it sounds like there's the idea of the black man's burden as it translates to the workplace. Like, A lot of black folks who I know, and not just black folks, but people who have identities that are not the most common at their workplace say, well, why should I do all the work of educating people?
Right. And it's very important that we as individuals recognize that there are entire firms and groups who work on making sure that these issues can actually be discussed in productive manners. So my job is to educate people on race, but it's not my job to coach my colleagues on being anti-racist, anti-sexist, or overly heteronormative or working against heteronormativity. You have to create the space to make your contribution, but also know when to step back, because taking that burden too far will mean that you probably won't be successful at your own job as you attempt to educate your colleagues.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was R. LaRue Lewis, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York, and he joined us from NPR's studios in New York. And now we're going to take the discussion to the life of the docks. The busiest ports in the country are right here in the backyard of our studio. The ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles see roughly 16 million containers every year, carrying everything from toilet paper to pickup trucks. Somebody has to unload and coordinate all that cargo, and it's not always a man. I've got Clovy Jean Good sitting with me here in the studio. She's a member of Southern California's Local 94 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Great to have you with us.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and it's great to see you. So take me back to 1984 when you first became what's called a longshoreman casual. What does that mean?
A longshore casual, that's part-time work in the industry. When they have an overflow of work, they have to hire part-time workers.
But what does a longshoreman... Well, first of all, do you call yourself a longshoreman, woman, person? How do
I call myself a longshoreman. That's the name, and that's the name that I go by. But you have a lot of women that would prefer to be called longshorewoman.
Okay. So what do you do?
We import, export, stevedoring, we load, unload vessels. We receive cargo that has to be shipped out to different countries. And we load and unload ships, organize the whole operation. When I first started, I was a part-time worker, and we just worked longshore. Longshore workers basically handled the labor part. Then as time went on, I became a marine clerk, which we organize everything that has to be done for us loading and unloading the vessels. And now in my latter years, my 24th year, I'm a longshore foreman, where actually I am a walking boss over longshoremen. I'm their boss.
Your dad set an example for you. What road did he have to walk to do what he did?
My father was a young man who became a longshoreman in the early 60s. And as we all know, back in the early 60s, African Americans was not given the opportunities as other different nationalities. So he was one of the first men that had to take on that struggle and had to fight for his rights to be able to be a skilled longshoreman, to be able to do all different aspects of the job and to open the doors so that when I decided to walk into the doors, that I would have an opportunity.
There were moments when he had a hard time, right, dealing with his coworkers?
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of hard times. You know, they wasn't accustomed to African-American men driving winches. It was only given to a certain category of men. So he had to take on those struggles to teach himself. No one was teaching him, training him, and he had to take on the responsibility of demanding the job, going out and working the job when everyone would leave off the vessels and didn't even want to work with an African-American man. Like, they didn't want to, you walked in a restaurant and they didn't want to eat in the same restaurant with you. They also did not want to work on the same vessels.
What did he say when his baby girl wanted to go and take this kind of a job?
Oh, he did not want that. He did not want his daughter on the waterfront. He felt that he had struggled long and far enough and that he didn't want me in that type of environment.
Why did you want to do it?
Because I was, you know, they say apple don't fall too far from the tree. I knew that it was a great career. I knew that it was excellent money, and I knew that I could become a great independent woman, help myself and help others. So I decided to that I had to do it.
What were give me an example of one of the worst moments that you've had to deal with and one of the best moments that you've had to deal with in your career?
Well, I would say one of the worst moments is, you know, as an African-American woman, the different cultures did not want to, I'm an aggressor. I want the best. I want to be the boss. I want to run the operation. And I had to take on that challenge. And so I had a lot of bad days because of people where everybody was fighting against a woman or African-American woman climbing the ladder. There was a glass ceiling there. So I had plenty of challenging days where I had to fight for my rights.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by fight for your rights?
Well, you know, I took on my employer. You know, I went ahead and I sued them, and I did what I had to do to break the glass ceiling so that women, African-American women, and everyone can have an equal employment opportunity.
What are or were some of the good moments? I mean, it sounds like you've moved up in the game.
Oh, the good moments is that, you know, I love the people. You know, I love going to work. I love the challenge. I love being the one who is running this big trillion-dollar operation. So every day that I go to work, you know, is a good day. You know, you can talk about the bad and things that have happened, but at the end of the day, it's all been a good day because you can teach people, you can train people, you can advise people on how to grow, how to, you know, learn how to drive a crane or go learn how to be a Marine clerk. So those are the good days because you can teach. I mean, I have the power to be able to teach and instruct with no problem.
Have you ever felt that you had to try to leave yourself at the door as a black woman?
No, I'm not leaving myself at the door. When I walk in as Clovie Jean Good. I know that I'm a beautiful person. I know that I hold God within my heart. So when I walk in the door, I walk in being who I am.
Who do you mentor?
My father.
You mentor your father?
No, I don't mentor him. You know what? I have a group of girls, 15 girls at the Los Angeles Will Rogers Willowbrook Boys and Girls Club. You're only supposed to have one girl, but, you know, I'm fortunate to have 15. So I have
That's a lot.
Yeah, so I mentor 15 girls. That's a secret, though. Don't nobody know I really do that, but I mentor.
They will now.
Yeah, I mentor every young lady that comes across my path. You know, that's what I do. I buy books and talk to children and talk to girls and teach them how to be better individuals.
Do any of them express an interest in being a longshoreman?
You know, a lot of people, everybody I know expressed the interest in being a longshoreman. I get phone calls every single day. But, you know, I always just tell them to get their education. You know, you don't know what you're going to do as you grow. So as long as you apply yourself and get good education and have some type of path that you're working for, some goal that you're working for, you have no idea what boat's going to ride by that you get to jump on.
One of the favorite things that I see when I look at you is that you have this very extravagant pen with a big silk yellow rose on it. And it's a very feminine part of who you are. And you're working in this very masculine field. Why are you carrying that pen?
You know, this is my good luck pen. My auntie, she made me about 12 of them. And everywhere I go, because I'm a writer, I usually write notes, take notes, and so I can always know what I'm talking about and being prepared. So I always carry this pen with me. You know, it's my writing tool. But I am very soft, so it's, you know, it's part of me.
All right. Well, Clovie Jean, it's great to hear from you, and it sounds like you and your dad are quite a team.
Yeah, we're quite a team.
We were speaking with Clovie Jean Good. She's a walking boss in Southern California's Local 94 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and she was right here with me with her beautiful flowered yellow rose pen in our NPR West studios in Culver City. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and that means it's time for sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. Let me ask you a question. How do you like your name, Farai Chidea?
Hey, it's me. I'm never going to change it.
I don't blame you. Well, I ask because people change their names all the time, but there was a name change by an NFL player from Tampa Bay this week. Let's let the sports bloggers tell us about it. I'm joined now by Marcus Vandenberg, a senior producer at BET.com and author of the sports blog Play a Hater, and Mike Tillery, who writes for the blog Starting Five. Hey, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So what's in a name? I guess it depends on who you are or who you want to be. Take the Buccaneers sophomore defensive end Gregory Alfonso White Jr., for example. He has legally changed his name to, drumroll please, Styles G. Yes, that's Styles, S-T-Y-L-E, with a Z at the end and G, period, for flavor, I guess. For you movie buffs out there, you may recognize this name from the 1985 movie Teen Wolf, starring Michael J. Fox. So, Mike, what do you think about this? Was the movie really that good?
I don't think it was really that good for me, but if you look at today's athletes, it's all about swagger. It's all about confidence. It's all about portraying a confident image. So maybe this is why he chose Styles P. I was reading a piece, and in the comments, somebody said, well, maybe he should have changed his name to Reggie White.
Oh, well, I don't know. Marcus, listen, other players like Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chad Ochocinco have paved the way for outlandish name changes. You guys may be too young to remember perhaps the most outlandish name change by an athlete in the 20th century. Lloyd Free of the Golden State Warriors legally changed his name to, and I'm not kidding, World Be Free back in the 1970s. You remember that, Marcus?
Yeah, I do. And I think World Be Free worked as opposed to Styles G. White. When I first heard the story, I had a Jim Moore moment. I was like, Teen Wolf? Teen Wolf? I mean, do we find a better movie to name yourself after than a 1985 Michael J. Fox film? Well, and I think we have Chad Johnson to blame for this. You know, he had his whole moment earlier in the season with Ochocinco changing his name. And come to find out, the NFL wouldn't let him wear the name Ochocinco on his jersey, so that sort of backfired. So I think, you know, this story is good for this week, but by next week we'll be saying Styles Who.
Well, you know, it's nothing if not creative. So let's move on to another topic. An outspoken person by his own name, Charles Barkley. He recently said that race was the number one factor in Auburn University's decision to hire football coach Gene Chizik, who is white, over what the Auburn alum says was a more qualified candidate, Turner Gill, who is black. Now, Barkley says the school played the race card plain and simple. Mike, what do you say?
Well, it is very unfortunate if you look at his Iowa State record. I think it was 5-19.
Yeah.
I think he didn't win a row game in 2 years, or something crazy like that.
10 in a row, 10 losses in a row.
Yes. I mean, what really is it going to take? I mean, I look at it like this. If Eddie Robinson wasn't seen as a contemporary, really, of Paterno, any of his coaching greats, how's a young black coach supposed to make any kind of inroads? There has to be something outspoken done. There has to be something done in this regard to shed the light on what – this is just abysmal. It's ridiculous. 4 coaches out of 100 – plus
119, absolutely, at Division I schools. Well, Marcus, Charles Barkley also mentioned that black coaches are not getting good jobs, he says, when they are hired, not at the big schools, with the notable exception perhaps of, you know, Ty Willingham, who went from Stanford to Notre Dame to Washington but got fired this season. You agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. If you look at the 4 coaches that are currently hired, Randy Shannon probably has the most high-profile job, and he's the head coach of Miami. The other 3, Turner Gill's at Buffalo, Kevin Sumlin is at Houston, and recently hired Mike Loxley is at New Mexico. Now, the last 3 programs aren't known for college football. Turner Gill has done a great job at Buffalo. They made the first bowl game since joining the bowl subdivision a few years ago in 1999. So I think that Turner Gill is putting Buffalo in the right direction, but I think Charles is absolutely correct that you're not seeing black coaches coach at USC, you know, Oklahoma. These prestigious programs aren't getting the same opportunities for black coaches. So,
well, you know, coaching is a tough job in any sport for any color. Just ask Reggie Theus, P.J. Carlissimo, Randy Whitman, Sam Mitchell, Mo Cheeks, Eddie Jordan. They have all been fired this season in the NBA. So talk about a short leash. NBA coaches are officially an endangered species, Mike.
I work with the Sixers regularly because I cover the team. And I'm from here, so it was cool growing up and following Mo Cheeks. It seems like when these owners come in, they want their GM. The GM wants their coach. The coach wants their point guard. So if that chain is broken in any way, you're going to have problems. Coaches and GMs, they just sometimes just don't mix. You have to win. You have to win right now, especially in the NBA.
So who's next, Marcus?
I think Nets is probably Jim O'Brien in Indiana. His team has struggled. They have a decent squad this year. You know, Don Nelson, also in Golden State, he's had some injuries, but also, you know, Golden State was an up-and-coming team. Now they're 7-19, so I think those two coaches are on the bubble.
Well, you know, Mike Dunleavy with the Clippers, he would have been in trouble had he not helped to oust their general manager. So now he's the boss. He would have to fire himself as the coach. We'll have to see what happens there. I do know one coach, though, guys, who ain't getting fired. Doc Rivers of the Boston Celtics. As of this morning, they were 25-2, third best start in franchise history, although they barely beat the pesky Atlanta Hawks on Wednesday night. So the question I have for you, Mike, is which conference is better, the East with Boston and Cleveland at the top or the West with the 21-3 Lakers at the top?
I would definitely go with the East. I think the East is a lot more balanced. You always are going to have the omnipresent Detroit Pistons who are always going to be there. I thought the West was overrated last year, and the performance in the playoff really showed. So Boston is really a juggernaut, and everybody else has just had to step in line and follow.
Well, you know, the one thing about the Eastern Conference, though, they have dominated the season so far in head-to-head competition, but the West, Marcus, has more teams above 500, nine of them compared to only five in the East.
Yeah, as a Los Angeles native, I have to sort of defend for the West here. You know, right now it's sort of Los Angeles and everyone else. Denver is the second best team in the West, but I don't know how many people really expect Denver to be there at the end of the season. I don't think the West was overrated last year. I just think that, you know, this season is sort of more balanced between the two conferences, and I think we're looking for a showdown between Boston and LA come June.
June? You mean next week, don't you? Christmas Day is going to be
Christmas
a showdown when they play next week. We'll see what happens, although betting money would have to go with the Celtics. They are more dominant so far. One last coaching question for you, Mike. It's this. You're in Philadelphia. Donovan McNabb is playing pretty well right now. That coming after the Eagles quarterback was controversially benched by head coach Andy Reid a few weeks ago. So did Reid do the right thing as coach by benching McNabb, and is that why everybody's playing better, including McNabb?
Well, I think it put everybody on notice to say, look, if you don't step up, you will get fired. So Donovan doesn't agree with the benching. He thinks that he was made a scapegoat. I talk to him all the time. He's cool. The team seems to be in lockstep with everything that he's trying to do. They don't want to see their quarterback benched anymore, and as a result, they're playing much better ball.
How far into the playoffs do you perceive or do you think that they will go?
If you look at the Giants last year, anything can happen. I don't see a dominant team. Right now, I think that Carolina is the best team in football based on their play right now. So anything can happen. As long as you get in, you got a shot.
Are any of the coaches, Marcus, surprising you so far? I'm thinking about Mike Tomlin, for example, in Pittsburgh, how well he has done as a first-year coach. Anybody stand out in your mind?
I think Bill Belichick. You have to give him some credit. You know, losing Tom Brady week one, having to deal with Matt Castle, a guy who never started USC behind Matt Leinart, Carson Palmer. I think you really have to give his team credit. Also, Tony Sperano in Miami. The whole AFC East is very competitive. And I think it's going to come down to the final week. So I think you have to give those two coaches credit.
All right, one more NFL question before we move on to the next topic, and it's this. Pro Bowl announcements came out this week. Brett Favre made the team. Mike, did he deserve to be ahead of even Pennington, for example, who's done well down in Miami? Or there are a number of other players who arguably could have gone ahead of Brett Favre.
I'm a traditional guy, and when greats are out there and they're on their last legs, I want to see them represented so young kids can see them, you know, in their last hurrah. They can see how great they are. Their dads can talk to them about who this guy was. So I don't have a problem with Brett Favre making it. Of course there are going to be better guys with better statistics that should be ahead of him. But I have no problem with Brett Favre being picked.
Well, let's talk about another form of recognition in a different sport. It's in golf. Here's something that doesn't happen very often of late. Golf's Player of the Year has been named, and it is not Tiger Woods, who has won nine times before. This year, the top prize went to Paddy Harrington, the first European to ever win it, and it followed his dual victories in the British Open and the PGA Championship. Now, Tiger had a very good but short year as well, although we don't know where he finished in the voting because the PGA totals are not disclosed for some crazy reason. Tiger's one-legged U.S. Open victory was phenomenal, of course, but apparently Marcus, just not enough. But the debate's still going on.
Yeah, I think Harrison deserved the award. You know, anytime you win two majors in a year, even though it's just only two wins of the season, that's pretty impressive. It would be hard, really, to vote for Tiger, considering he hasn't played in the last 6 months. But he's just keeping – Harrington's just keeping the award warm for Woods next year when he comes back.
For next year. What do you say, Mike?
I say the same thing. I don't know, though, because, I mean, Tiger won 4 of 6, including a U.S. Open. So,
that's right.
You know, I think Patty won because he was the first European since 1990. He's the second since Tiger in the last 20 years with two majors. So anytime you're linked with Tiger, you're going to have the light shined on you.
Well, I guess he had his one opportunity because Tiger's already said he's coming back next year. He'll be ready for the majors. So we can expect that the POI will be going to Tiger Woods once more next year, won't we? All right, final thing is this. Let's finish with a sport that we honestly don't talk about very much here. That's hockey. And if sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you, then try telling that to Sean Avery, now formerly of the Dallas Stars. A couple of weeks ago, you may recall, Avery made some pretty nasty comments about his celebrity ex-girlfriends dating other hockey players. We won't repeat it here, but suffice it to say, it cost him a 6-game suspension at first, but then got worse when the Stars pulled up the welcome mat. Avery's mouth got him essentially thrown off the team, didn't it, Mike?
Yes, it definitely did. I think Avery is gone because of his past wrongdoings. I don't think it really had anything to do with these last comments. The NHL, nobody's watching it. Nobody really cares anymore. I think that the NHL really dropped the ball here with the suspension. Why the comments are very unfortunate. I think they were very wrong. I don't think that he should have been suspended for saying such.
Well, let me ask you, Marcus, because Avery has since admitted that he does have anger issues and he is reportedly getting some help. Do you think that the punishment fits the crime?
No, I don't. You know, Sean Avery's had a history, though, of sort of running his mouth. He allegedly called George LaRocque a monkey. He's had issues in the past with other players in the league. He's arguably the most hated player in the NHL. So this isn't a surprise that he essentially got fired for running his mouth. It's just a shame that, you know, people are talking about the NHL for this instead of San Jose, who's 25-3-3.
Exactly.
They're talking about the negative instead of the positive. So that's really sad for the NHL.
Well, that's true, although they are talking about the NHL, which is something that a year ago they weren't doing at all. Guys, thank you very much. Happy holidays. Watch your mouth. Don't change your name.
Thanks, Tony. Happy holidays to you.
Happy
as
holidays.
Well.
Mike Tillery writes for the blog Starting Five, and Marcus Vandenberg is a senior producer at BET.com and author of sports blog Player Hater, speaking to us from NPR Studios in New York City.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
Well, I'm planning vacation time. As most of our listeners know, National Public Radio has decided to cancel News and Notes. Our final day of broadcast will be March 20th, 2009.
And, you know, it was really amazing. That announcement really flooded our letters mailbox. It was overwhelming and really touching to see the responses we got from our listeners. I've picked out a few highlights from our mailbag.
Here's one from Morgan Keenan in St. Louis, Missouri. She wrote, "I heard about you guys not being around anymore. Tell me it's not true. You are the first radio program that made me fall in love with NPR. Thank you so much for all your hard work and all that you do." Well, Morgan, I have some good news, which is that one of the highlights of this year was spending debate night in St. Louis at UMSL with the Talk of the Nation crew, plus the kind folks at the university and at station KWMU. Hi, guys. Love you. Thanks, Morgan.
Then Jonathan Brownlee in South Florida wrote us this. "As a gay white man of 39 years, I'm very sorry to hear News and Notes is being axed. I'm devastated, really. Not only have I learned a great deal from the black perspective, I've greatly appreciated the honest, fair, positive, and compassionate depiction and treatment of gay people on your show. It's good to be treated equally for a change. Thank you. Much love and luck, and happy holidays."
Sharon Chase in Washington, D.C. sent us this. I'm very sorry to hear that News and Notes will be going off the air in March. It's a quality program that is informative and entertaining. Programs like this that NPR provides have made me want to recycle my TV once and for all, much to my husband's dismay. I am making a donation to NPR to help in the small way that I can.
And Gina Pera in San Mateo, California, sent us this. I'm a 52-year-old white person, and this is one of my favorite shows. So if you think that this show has, quote, limited appeal, think again. Please cancel something else.
And finally, Joe Bennett in Dallas, Texas, chimed in with this. I am very disappointed that of all the shows that could be canceled, News and Notes was. It's the only one that is specifically addressing the concerns of African Americans. As an American with African heritage, I think it is very important to have my issues addressed on the airwaves. I'm sure that you will say that the other shows address these issues. However, I disagree in the format in which they do. More often than not, it is addressed not from the African American perspective.
And that's it for letters. Thank you so much for your letters and love this week. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few months.
To write to us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us and keep writing to us. We're here with you for 3 more months.
Also, be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us and continue to share your time with us. You can visit us online at nprnewsandnotes.org. That is our show page, or our blog and newsletter at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow we look at what the federal government is planning to do about huge financial frauds like the Bernard Madoff scandal, which may cost Americans tens of billions of dollars. We'll be right back.